Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for. Hello and welcome to this special episode of BoAgWorld.com. The reason it's a special episode is because today I'm going to list my top 5 reasons why I don't want to be recording this podcast. My reason number 1 is I've lost the ability to swallow. My reason number 2 is because snot is currently streaming out of my nose, over my lips and onto my chin.
Too much detail, sorry.
Number 3... it has forced me to get out of bed. But this is where it gets serious. Number 4. Steve Jobs is currently in the UK, about to, in 20 minutes, make an announcement in the UK. Number 5. The O2 store is down. What this means is that I shouldn't be sitting here podcasting. I should be sitting out of in front of an O2 store ready to buy my iPhone. But as I feel like shit, that's not going to happen anyway.
I thought the iPhone wasn't going to be out until about next January or something.
Well, it might be. I mean, that's still a possibility, but they're definitely going to be announcing it today, and it will be appearing on the O2 store. However, it might just be for pre-ordering. So let's hope that that's the case, because at the moment, I feel too shit to go and stand in front of an O2 store.
So, well, I'm going to go and buy a phone this afternoon.
Are you? What are you buying?
Maybe I'll buy an iPhone. Hey.
If you do...
you'll kill me.
I will never podcast with you ever, ever again.
I'll tell you it's a Nokia or
just
something.
Yeah, just lie to me, will you? I feel so rough. I feel so ill. Okay, but we can do this. If Zay Frank can record a podcast every day of, you know, for however long he did it, and be funny and entertaining while feeling like shit, and in half of them seems to be hungover, then I can do this. Have you ever seen Zay Frank's podcast?
No, I haven't. I've heard of it.
It's so funny. He really is an incredibly funny guy. And he literally did one every day. Eventually he burnt out, unsurprisingly. But they were very funny. If you haven't checked that out before, then do a search on The Show by Zay Frank. That's Z-E Frank. Very good indeed. Anyway, hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. Nice long weekend.
Yes.
And Paul's Monday.
The idea was that, I took Friday and Monday off, that because I was having trouble getting into writing and I was feeling a bit run down. And so, and I've been really busy last couple of weeks. So I thought I'll take a couple of days off and then come back refreshed. And instead, I've come back with a cold. I do blame my son because he's just started school. And so now he's a carrier for every disease on the planet.
Yeah, I remember that. On the subject of children, it's my daughter's 15th birthday today.
Oh, everyone. Is it? Hey,
yeah.
Congratulations to her.
Happy birthday.
So are you going to have a house full of teenage girls? Or probably teenage boys now?
Oh, yeah, that definitely. No, no, they like to go out to dinner now. They all go off to a signings in the town or something.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. That kind of thing.
It must be quite nice to reach that age where they go away on their birthday.
Yeah.
We're
taking her out to dinner tonight with grannies and things. So that's our bit.
Ah, I see. Okay, so what are we doing on this week's show? What, Marcus, what are you doing? You kick us off, will you?
Yeah, sure, why do you need a little rest?
Yeah.
Just to catch his breath, everyone.
Just to wipe your nose, that kind of thing.
I'm going to talk about using client references, talking to your clients about whether they will be a referee for you or not, that kind of thing.
Ah, that sounds quite good. I'm going to be, what am I going to be doing? I'm going to be looking at Flickr, the photo sharing website, and seeing what lessons can be learned from that. And I have to say, basically, this is a huge ripoff of Tom Coates' presentation at Deconstruct this year. So you might be better off just going and downloading that podcast instead of listening to me full of cold, copying what he said much more eloquently.
Just do it in a bullet point style. Get it over in about a minute.
And then we'll all go home. It'll be a short show today, I bet. Well, that or it'll be a really long show because I keep having to stop every 2 minutes and, you know,
sniff,
cough up a lung or something. Okay, we've also got Patrick McNeil from Design Meltdown on the show in an interview I recorded when I wasn't feeling so ill, so that should be quite a good bit of the show, and you might want to just skip to that bit. But before we get onto all of that good stuff, obviously, we have to start with our news.
Birdworld.com.
Okay, deep breath as I plunge into the news. Let's see if I can get through it all in one go. First up is developing your designs with your client. Now, this is quite interesting that I came across this week, because last week's show, I started to kind of talk about how I was reconsidering the way that we manage projects, and that I'm kind of considering a more agile approach to kind of project management, really, and, you know, running a web project. So this is kind of all about the principles of agile development. And if you haven't looked up agile development before, then go and check it out on Wikipedia, and that'll tell you much more about it than I could. And I'll put a link in the show notes as well. But the idea, or one of the ideas of agile development, is you get the entire development team working together. So designer, developer, project manager, everybody basically. Now, I'm not an expert at agile development. I'm only just kind of learning about it, really. But from what I can gather, it's also a good idea to encourage the client to be involved in this way too, and actively involve them in the development process. Now, I have to say, this made me a little nervous, this kind of idea of including the client too much in the process. And I was having trouble getting my head around it. My problem is that agile development is this kind of very fluid process, and I'm not sure that I'm keen to expose the client to that level of our internal chaos, if that makes sense. Yeah. However, although I'm kind of still learning what I think about this, and I haven't really reached any final conclusions over it, I was impressed by an article that was released this week on the A List Apart website. And the article talked about including clients in the process of developing your website through a series of kind of workshops where you could get them involved and therefore kind of committed to the project and what you're doing. But what I liked about it is instead of just kind of having them involved in the process in a kind of unstructured way, this proposed a kind of semi-structured approach of using workshops, and so that kind of addressed some of my concerns. Now, I have to say I'm still not convinced about the agile approach to development, but yeah, I'm warming to the idea. So I suppose I ought to explain very briefly what agile is, but I'm afraid of making a fool of myself because I'm still learning about it. But basically, I think the principle is that instead of going through a project in a linear fashion, so, specification stage, design stage, development stage, testing stage, etc., that instead you go through these kind of little blitz of spurts of doing different bits of the, you know, the project. So let's say you were building an e-commerce site. You might have one micro project that was just the checkout system, and you would specify that, and you would design it and develop it, and everybody would work together just to blitz that one piece of functionality within the site. And then you'd take another area like the product listing, and you do the same for that.
But surely information architecture still has to come at the start, because that's a kind of, you need to look at the whole thing. You can't look at information architecture in little bits because they all relate to each other.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And this is where I'm having trouble getting my head around it. Probably we need to get somebody that's much more knowledgeable on this. But I think the key is that you kind of include everybody in that process. You don't have a situation where just the information architect is putting together that. You know, he's doing that very much alongside the designers and the developers and everybody else at the same time.
That makes sense. I like that.
Yeah, I like that, working in little mini teams. So it's something I'm looking at, but I am learning about it. So please don't take what I say as gospel over that. Okay, next.
No, it does, Paul. No,
nobody
does.
Ever takes me, yeah, as gospel. okay, next up. Where to start with this one? Yes, is it? I think I recently. Oh God, I'm so struggling today, aren't I?
I've got the words here, Paul. Shall I read it out instead?
Yeah, go on. You read it.
Become a better illustrator. Item number two in the news.
Is that it? I thought you were going to do the whole thing, so I could put my feet.
Yeah, but
up.
That would sound really kind of. I start reading out your words, wouldn't it? It's funny how you can be told something is great countless times, And yet somehow you never get around to checking it out. You just take over whenever you're ready, Paul.
Okay. Well, up until this week, that was true for me when it came to the video podcast produced by Anton Beck. Oh, God. I'm sorry, Anton. Yes. So I met Anton last year at South by Southwest, and everybody was going on about what a great illustrator he was, and I really got on well with him and all the rest of it, and you kind of then vaguely kept in contact with him via things like Twitter and IM. But I never really got around to having a poke around his site and seeing what, you know, what he did in any detail. However, this week he's kind of launched a new version of his site, and he I think IM'd me about it, and so I thought I'd have a look, you know, at politeness. And I have to say, blown me away. He's got some really great stuff. Not only is he the incredible illustrator everybody says he is, he's also put together a series of video podcasts. And he's got some really great advice about being a better illustrator, basically, in these video podcasts. And he looks at things like working with colors, how to create realistic skin tones, custom Photoshop brushes, and all that kind of stuff. And after chatting with Anton and basically saying, oh, I really like what you've done, it's really good, really good, he's basically said that he's going to concentrate more on those. So I think there'll be more and more of those video tutorials coming out. So if you are any kind of budding illustrator, or if, like me, you're just in awe of anybody that's got the ability to draw, then go along and check out what he's done, because it's really good, very entertaining. And subscribe to it as well so that you can see the new ones as they come out in the future. So, yes, we managed to get to the end of that story eventually. Sorry, Anton, for screwing up your plug on the show. Anyway, there seems to be, in my next news story, a never-ending torrent of spam these days. Can you tell I'm just reading this? This is so bad, isn't it?
What do you mean, these days? There's been a never-ending torrent of spam for, all my life at least.
Oh, don't be... Well, yes.
I know there wasn't the internet when...
Do you know, postal spam annoys me now more than the internet, because you can just, filter out electronic spam. But it's like...
Delete.
Yeah, every day another tree is pushed through my letterbox, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. Very annoying.
There is, actually.
Oh, no, there isn't. They say, you can get yourself removed from the mailing list, but it expires every year, and you have to...
No, this is Marcus's way of dealing with it. What you do is, on any form... You fill in for, I don't know, you want to subscribe to a magazine or something like that. Mm-hmm. Spell your name wrong on the form. But in a way that you will recognise again as that was the misspelling of my name.
Okay.
So when it comes through, so that magazine comes through, it's got your misspelled name on it. Great. But then when you get any spam with that misspelling of the name, you know who it was that sold your details. You then... ring them up or write to them, and they get very, very nervous about it and immediately remove you from their database, which I've done on more than one occasion. So there you go.
Oh, well, there you go. But people spell my name wrong all the time anyway, so it really wouldn't tell me very much.
It's a way that you've never seen before and you know was your way.
Okay. Right. Fine.
Anyway, sorry, a bit of a tangent there.
Yeah, but quite a useful, a kind of life hacker type, you know. Term. Yeah. Yeah, very good. So, yes, I mean, to be honest, spam in my email, I can kind of cope with. I've kind of come to terms with that. Spam through the post, really don't like, but Marcus has just solved that for me, apparently.
That solved it.
But the spam that's particularly tricky is the spam that arrives via forms on your website. And these really hack me off. And there have been loads of solutions put forward to this, you know, like Capture, for example, when it shows you that image and you have to try and type in the numeric values that appear in the image. But half of these things have accessibility problems, or they kind of put the emphasis on the user to prove that they're not a kind of spam bot. And so I didn't really like any of them very much. And there are a few kind of filtering services, but they aren't really 100% effective, and many of them you have to pay for. So I was a bit like... Well, I mean, there's no good solution to this, or that's how it felt. Now, however, fortunately, some clever spark has come up with a new approach to the problem that I have to say I really like. Sounds good. It relies on the fact that bots go crazy whenever they encounter a form. Turned into a Radio 1 DJ. Oh, God, help me. Kill me now. So they go crazy whenever they encounter a form and start randomly filling in the fields. The technique involves, basically the idea is that you create an additional field that's got a particularly tempting name to these bots, something like body, so it thinks that that's where you enter the main body of the, you know, the comment. And the bots can't resist kind of completing this field, while in actual fact, as far as the user is concerned, you've hid it entirely by moving it off screen with CSS or hiding it with JavaScript or whatever else. Now, what's really great is that you have a piece of validation that basically checks to see whether that field has been filled in. If the field has been filled in, then you know it's a bot. So you've kind of turned the problem around.
So that's instead of so it, simple, isn't it?
I know, why what a genius idea. I know. So there you go. So it's a really great idea. Now, there are a few accessibility problems with it. So, for example, a screen reader user will come across that particular field. But that's fine. All you do is you associate a label with it that says something like, I'm really sorry you've got to, you know, see this, but, you know, this is a ignore this field kind of thing and explain why. So the screen reader user is slightly inconvenienced by having to ignore the field, but beyond that, no big deal. But I just think it's such a great idea. It's kind of a honey trap field that lures the bots in and tricks them. So I like that one. Okay. Last news story of the day. Hooray! I'm almost at the end. When I was kind of preparing this, hey, do you think I can pass you a cold over the microphone? There you go.
No, you've just given it to everyone now.
Oh, no! I only meant to give it to you. Sorry, guys. Yes, so when I was preparing these news stories, it occurred to me that it's been ages since I've actually done a decent kind of news story for you hardcore designers out there. So I thought I would end today's news segment with one for you. So the Web Designers Wall, which I've mentioned before, a really good site, has published a list of Photoshop secret shortcuts that are ludicrously useful. They've got some really good stuff in there. Now, I've been using Photoshop. Do you know, I realized I've been using Photoshop since the initial version 1. Do you know, back in those, here we go. When I was a lad, young people today don't know they've got it so good. In the first version of Photoshop, there weren't even layers. You made a change, and that was it. There was no going back.
There's no going back.
There was no going back. You used to, every time you made any significant change, you would save a new version so that you could roll back. There was no history. There was no undo. No, not multiple levels of undo. It was just bad. So anyway, I've been using it since that initial version, and I wasn't aware of half of these shortcuts. There's some really great stuff. So, for example, did you know that you can navigate a document left to right using a key combination and the scroll wheel? Did you know that you can scale font sizes using the arrow key?
Did you know that?
Did you know that you can zoom with the scroll wheel? Actually, I did know that one. I don't know why I put that one on the list. That you can drag to change numerical values, things like pixel sizes and stuff like that. That you can use keyboard shortcuts to expand or collapse all of the layer groups in your layer panel. That you can even easily hide and show multiple layers all in one go. Really great stuff. Really good list. I've just picked out some random ones there. Check out the article.
I like the double click the magnifying glass to go to 100%. Didn't know that one.
Ah, did you not? I knew that one, which is why I didn't include it. But yeah, I mean, it's a really good list. Hey, Marcus, that means you must have actually looked at this article to know that one, because that's not in my list.
Yes.
Wow.
See, I do sometimes. Well, I use Photoshop quite a bit, not that much, but quite a bit. So I thought, oh, I might learn something. It's not just your usual rambling, you know.
I see. Okay. Well, that's good. Well, let's move on, talking of rambling, to Marcus's section of the show. Birdwide.com.
Okay, my bit.
While you're doing this, then, I'm just going to do the live feed from the Apple announcement. So if I don't reply, it's because I'm doing this. Carry on.
You don't care about what I say.
No. didn't care about what I said. You just said you only read the news articles if it's not my normal waffle.
Well, yeah, but that's you. This is me.
Oh, I see. And you're more important, are you?
Yeah. Anyway, right. Using client references. Basically, you're looking for new work. You want to add, or usually you get asked to supply some kind of reference from a previous client. And this is quite a tricky subject for me to talk about because I know that some of the clients that we Headscape use as references listen to this show.
So, oh, dear.
I'll I'll try and keep it fairly sort of on the level. So I think the first thing that you need to do is to judge whether a client that you're working with or just work with would make a good reference for you. So ask yourself these kind of things. Did I deliver the budget? Did I deliver the project on time and on budget? If you did, then chances are you've got a happy client. Did I deliver a quality website, a cool website,
you can't say it now, woohoo!
Innovative. This is catching, I'm sure. So in other words, did you exceed the expectations of that particular client? Next one, really important, did you get on with the client? And this is probably slightly more sort of one that you might not think of, but is the client web savvy, i.e. do they understand what you do in a little bit more detail than sort of the average guy on the street? Because the question you've got to ask yourself there is, would you be happy for them to talk to another potential client about what you can do? And if you think, well, hang on a minute, they don't really know what we do. I mean, they trusted us and we did a good job and everyone was happy, but they're not particularly web savvy, then you might not want them to be in that position. Final point on this particular list is, would the client's company, would the name, the brand, their reputation help yours? Because you might have to, I suppose what I'm thinking here, if you did work for a huge corporation that everyone knows, then obviously you want them as a reference. But you may have done a site for a particularly dodgy company that you don't want anyone to know that you did it. That kind of thing. If the answers to most of these questions are generally yes, then you really should try to get them to act as a referee for you, or failing that, at least get some kind of testimonial out of them. Well, I'll talk about testimonials next week, I think. Of course, if the answers are generally no, but the client was, I don't know, Coca-Cola, then chances are you should try and use them anyway. So you've decided that you want this particular client to be a reference for you, but don't just assume that they'll be happy to do it for you. Always ask, well... Yeah, sometimes I've included people in the past. I mean, I have asked them, but I've carried on using them. But I'll come on to that in a minute. Always ask people if they mind doing it, because it quite often involves some work on their part. What usually you get some kind of form. And you sometimes people will just phone up, but you often get an email form to fill in, and you think, well, you know, that's actual work, and it's time out of their day on your behalf. So you need to ask them. I've asked clients in the past if I can just include their details in an ongoing fashion, which is what you really want, and most of them agree to this, but I still make a point of checking in with them every, say, 6 months or so to see if it's still okay. Because the last thing you want is someone getting tired of you asking for the reference, because they'll end up sounding tired of the process, basically, with the prospective client. When you're asking people about this, try and read between the lines, because nearly everyone will say yes, no problem. But if you really think that they don't want to do it, then maybe save them up for a particularly big client. Just use them once or something like that, or a particularly appropriate client. Sometimes tenders ask for a very large amount of references, which is really annoying. They want every client you've ever worked with. Basically, we've had in those kind of tenders in the past. In those cases, what I do is include all the contact details, but ask them that I'm contacted first before they ring anyone, so that I can just ring up who they want to speak to.
Yeah.
You also need to kind of vary the list, because not all tenders ask for references. This is a bit of an aside. If that is the case, don't include any. Don't include some just because you think people will want to read it, because, I suppose what I'm saying here is these are valuable and there's a finite use to them. People will eventually get hacked off by being included in your proposals, so don't include them unless people ask for them. I do is simply add in a line saying that references can be supplied on request, along with insurance details and other such stuff. Financial one, that's the other one. But for those that do ask, don't roll out the same old names every week, if you like. Because they'll end up getting hacked off with you continually including them. But the main reason for not doing this is that you should try to include appropriate references for that particular prospective client. Obviously, similar organisations. We did quite a lot of countryside sites, then I'll try and include countryside type references. But you also might want to consider If this prospective client is, I don't know, very techie or something like that, then you want, then look for another kind of techie type client to talk to them, because chances are they'll get on pretty well. The final one point that I'd like to make is sometimes you'll get clients that you get on really, really well with, and they'll give you feedback on, you know, they'll tell you what they, or they'll give you a copy of their response. My advice on that is don't read it, because well, I've fallen into the trap quite recently, not that long, a few months ago, where I was sort of like, you can't say that about us. And I thought, well, no, they can say what they like about us, to be honest. So I guess what I'm saying is it's not your business, really. It's between these two other groups. So if you, that's my final piece of advice. Don't get involved in the process. If somebody's kind enough to do it for you, just let them do it and get on with it. And that's me for this week.
Well, I'm pleased to tell everybody at the moment that people are beginning to arrive at the Apple event, and people don't really care, do they?
No one cares. It's a phone, Paul.
I know. I'm obsessive compulsive. What can I say? Okay. So thank you very much, Marcus, for that informative whatever it was. I can't say I was paying attention.
It was a ramble.
Was it good? Were you good this week?
Middling.
You weren't at your best. Well, I read through what you wrote.
Not dreadful.
Okay, that's good. All right, well, let's move on to me, because obviously I'm what everybody listens for. Bugworld.com. Okay, so let's move on to my segment of the show after about the third attempt, because the doorbell goes and the telephone goes and it's one of those days. Okay. So, yes, this year at Deconstruct, I was really inspired, as I said at the beginning of the show, by Tom Coates. I've got to say, he really challenged my perception about web design and the fact that kind of I perceive it as being all about websites, when actually it can be a lot more than that. And basically, he was saying that instead, as website owners, we need to start thinking about what content we hold rather than the method by which it's delivered. These days, the web's becoming less about websites and more about content delivery, kind of in all its various forms. So once you kind of wrap your head around this fact, it really is quite inspiring and offers lots of new interesting opportunities. But one of the things that he did in his talk, which I was hugely in favor of, is that he kind of used a real world example and looked at the photo sharing site Flickr, which I'm sure most of you are aware of. So what I want to do is basically the same thing as he did, maybe present things in a little bit of a different way, probably not as good. But just to give you a taste of what was covered, and I do encourage you to go and listen to the podcast as well on that. So Flickr realized kind of very early on in their life cycle that they were really about photos and not actually kind of running a website, if that makes sense. And central to kind of Flickr's philosophy of life, the universe and everything is kind of empowering users to share their photos and do stuff with their photos. And so as far as they're concerned, it doesn't really matter how users share their photographs and through what medium. They don't really care about that. What matters to them is that photographs are exposed to the biggest audience possible. And by opening up their content via an API, and we've talked about APIs before, Flickr photos can be kind of accessed through a huge variety of different methods, including... Oh, I've just been pinged by Harry. iPhone in the UK with O2... it's so exciting. £269 for 8 gig. Oh, that's crap. Available November the 9th. Can't wait that long. Right, I'm logging out now in disgust.
It won't be available then.
November the 9th, my arse.
Might get it in February if you're lucky.
Anyway, was I saying something? Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I was actually partially interested there.
Oh, now right. You've lost me. Oh, I've lost you. I've lost the listener. Mm-hmm. So anyway, by opening up their kind of API, Flickr photos can be accessed through a kind of huge variety of different methods, you know, above and beyond kind of the obvious, the Flickr website. So you can access Flickr photos through kind of mobile devices, through desktop widgets, even through kind of Wi-Fi photo frames, through third-party desktop applications, through third-party websites, and even through printed material, such as like the Moo cards and things like that. So they've really kind of opened up the possibility. So in short, Flickr has let go of the concept of driving traffic to their website and instead focused on putting their content in front of as many people as possible. Now, you kind of may be thinking, well, how does this apply to me? I mean, after all, I don't run a photo sharing site. However, the principles can apply to almost any type of content. So take, for example, your humble blog. A blog is made up of individual kind of blog posts, isn't it? Each of these are content items that could be delivered through almost any of the mechanisms that I mentioned earlier, whether it be a mobile device, desktop widget, maybe not the Wi-Fi photo frame, but, you know, third-party desktop applications, third-party websites, or even in printed format. Equally, you might be, say, running a university and have a database of courses. Again, why limit that data to your own website when it could be pushed out in all these other mediums? It could just as easily be delivered, you know, to a much wider audience than just the website by itself. See, Amazon get this idea. They've had an API since the dawn of time, basically, far beyond any of the kind of current crop of Web 2.0 sites. And they're happy to push out their product lines beyond the confine of their website. Of course, in doing so, they lose some level of control over their content and how it's perceived, but that's kind of offset by the massive amounts of additional customers that are exposed to their brand and their products. However, it's not just the Flickr API that should impress you. There's also really cool stuff they're doing as far as navigation and organization of their content. So take, for example, an average Flickr page, you know, Flickr photograph. If you go to a page on the Flickr website which has got a single photograph in, it contains loads of information more than just the photo itself. Each photo is associated with it a massive additional information, kind of known as metadata. Just some of the data held on a photo includes things like the title, its description, comments made on the photo set that the photo belongs to, the user that uploaded the photo, tags on the photo, notes on the photo, copyright restrictions, longitude and latitude of the location the photo was taken in, the type of camera that was used, the settings that were used when taking the photograph. The list kind of goes on. However, what is interesting is not the amount of data that is available about a photo, but the fact that it's possible to navigate by almost any of these criteria. You can search on title, description, tag, and pretty much anything else. You can click to see a photograph of a user who has commented, you know, on your photograph, and or even see all of the photos that have got a certain copyright restriction, like are released under Creative Commons or whatever else. You can view photographs geographically on a map, and you can even look at photographs that have a certain, which were taken with a certain f-stop, for crying out loud. Yeah. And this kind of richness of navigation really helps the kind of user navigate around a huge amount of data. I mean, they have like a billion photographs on Flickr. It enables users to quickly and easily find what they're looking for, as well as exposing them to kind of maybe content that they wouldn't have previously found.
I love Flickr.
I mean, it's an awesome site. And again, there's kind of loads that we can learn from it. In particular, there is real benefit here for e-commerce sites. Building up kind of rich metadata around products and allowing users to navigate via that will expose them to many more products, but at the same time also allow them to narrow their search much quicker if they want to. So, for example, on an e-commerce site, users could choose to navigate via customer ratings or brand names, as well as more kind of traditional categories. You know, with our blog example from earlier, a user could navigate via tags, by author, or even by the number of comments, you know, show me the most commented on articles. The possibilities really are endless. Of course, as with anything, the approach is not without its risks. Without the kind of clean, simple design implemented by Flickr, users could quickly become overwhelmed by too many options. And Flickr do this very well about creating a very strong hierarchy, so users know where they are within the, you know, within the site structure and which metadata is more important and what's less. But they don't hide away those options; they just create a sense of simplicity using a kind of hierarchical approach. So I guess the key to this approach is to start thinking beyond the page metaphor and to start looking at the content that you have in terms of data type. Obviously, this approach doesn't work well for all content. For example, I don't envisage pushing the About Us page out to third-party applications. I mean, you know, what's the point? However, most sites contain some form of key data to which this principle applies. The trick is identifying what those key content areas are and trying to work with them. So there you go. I thought that was kind of interesting. It was a very enlightening presentation by Tom, and I haven't done it justice, so please download that when that podcast comes out. Right, should we move on to our interview for today?
Yeah.
You're happy to move on, Marcus? Is that okay with you?
I think it's about time we did, really.
I don't really want to cut you off, because I know you complain about that, so I just want to make sure you've said everything you want to say.
I'm looking at Flickr now, so, fine.
Okay, you've moved on. Okay. Birdworld.com.
So joining me today is Patrick McNeil, who is probably best known for Design Meltdown, although you seem to be running a whole plethora of sites at the moment, Patrick.
Yeah, I keep busy for sure.
That's good. So I wanted you on the show really because from Design Meltdown, it's very apparent that you kind of follow what's going on as far as design trends online. I thought it'd be good to get you into the current design trends and that kind of thing. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about how Design Meltdown came about.
Well, it started in school, actually. I had a teacher it was one of my design classes, and we were using this book titled Genius Moves by Stephen Heller. Mm-hmm. And basically in the book, he catalogs design over the last 100 years by these just totally random things like big text and, I don't know, big hands and strange little things that you would never think to classify design on. And so it got me thinking about web stuff, and I started snapshotting sites and started building a folder structure of stuff. And then I realized, hey, I can make a little website out of this. And that's pretty much how it got started.
So, I mean, it's probably worth saying that it's a lot more than, the normal kind of screenshot sites that you see. It's, it's more of a blog organized in categories. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I kind of view it as a catalog of websites, basically. Kind of like your, I don't know, it's almost like a library of stuff, basically, right?
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely more as opposed to just kind of a showcase of beautiful sites, it's more a showcase of sites in particular classifications to where they kind of make sense to go together.
Yeah, and you kind of you seem to give a bit of a commentary about what you're seeing in these different things, which looks like it's led on to a kind of a regular column in .NET magazine as well, I notice.
Yeah, I've been writing for .NET for about a year and a half now, monthly basis, and basically it's the same thing there too. I pick some kind of strange category and comment on it, and it seemed to me that was one of the, when I started it, not only did I want to catalog the sites and kind of show them in a new way from the other galleries, but I thought the commentary, and I don't know, it felt kind of weird writing about stuff at first, it feels so egotistical or something, but just the commentary seemed to be something that was new to kind of that area of discussion or whatever. I mean, it was usually just here's a bunch of cool looking sites to look at them, instead of kind of write my thoughts on the topic,
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you've been doing this for a while now. The site's been up and running for a while. Tell us a little bit about what you feel you've learned through the process in regards to design and web design in particular.
Well, I mean, certainly by kind of monitoring moderating the sites that come in and then cataloging them, I'm forced to look at hundreds of sites. So inevitably you're a little more exposed, I think, to what's going on. So a lot of times I feel like I kind of have a feel for what is popular at any given time, mm-hmm. which is really strange to feel that in touch. I know we all surf a lot, but it just seems kind of excessive because I have all these people submitting me their latest and greatest sites. So it kind of puts you in touch with what's going on. But I think probably the biggest design lesson I've learned is, and we should know this because, you go to school for it and whatever, but that everything has meaning. Even the most trivial, insignificant seemingly things have abundant meaning to them. And one of the perfect examples is I commented on the badge on BOAG World, right? Mm. That's how you found me, I think, actually.
Yeah.
But you think the badge, and I would have just used it flippantly or something. And I think my commentary on it initially was even kind of poking fun at it almost.
Yeah.
But then you realize there's actual power in that tool. Everything is a tool, and everything can potentially have meaning, all the way down to there's a pattern to fold over a corner to make it look like the page has been turned over, like you would in a real book.
Yeah.
And you know, things like that I might initially have thought were meaningless. And after doing this for a while and you see enough sites that did the same thing, you're like, well, there actually kind of is some, you know, thought process that can go into that. And you can put some meaning into just about anything. So it's kind of fascinating, I think. Mm. Makes me think more about the design elements that I would choose to use, seeing how that they, you know, they have more meaning.
So how has it influenced the kind of the designs that you're producing these days?
Well, I don't produce a whole lot of design, ironically. I tend to be more of a developer,
but,
which is kind of sad, but I definitely do get to do like a mix of things. But I think it just makes me more aware of like what exactly I'm doing and a little more conscientious when I go to implement something that I don't just say, oh, well, I think these shiny sites look cool lately, so I think I'll make a shiny site, you know, or, you know, I want a badge on my site. It just makes me, I think, you know, just think things through a little bit better and not do things so flippantly and try to consider what the real purpose of the site is and what the message is or that sort of thing. And then to, you know, come up with design elements that follow that need, I guess.
I mean, you said a minute ago that you've kind of been forced by doing this to become very aware of what design trends are around. What do you think's going on at the moment? What are the emerging trends that you're seeing looking around at the minute?
Well, certainly there's one that seems pretty obvious. Is like everybody has made a shiny website by now, you know, like where everything's all glossy. And I think that's gone through some interesting patterns. But it seems that lately there's been and this is probably true of almost any trend. Like at first, it's just kind of used on randomly and not very well. And then over time, it becomes more integrated into the way designers work. And so like the results now are sites that are just absolutely beautiful. They like completely use the style as opposed to just saying, I'm going to make a shiny logo. Like it really is used throughout the entire design and creates a whole unified feel to it, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So it just seems like patterns like that where you see it more effectively used. And the other one, which I think is probably, and this has been going on for a little while now, but it's certainly a big trend, is that like the idea of more rapid communications. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of how short attention spans are on the web.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go to a lot of sites now where they'll have like and it's almost sometimes bigger than the logo, a bold statement in like 10 words or less about what exactly this company does.
Yeah.
And it used to be you'd go to some site and sometimes sometimes now when you find an older site, I guess, like you're confused about what the product is. You can't even tell by looking at the homepage, like what the heck does this company sell? Mm-hmm. And so nowadays it seems like of the utmost importance, there's so many like applications for doing this, that, or the other. And like to clearly say, this is an online accounting software or, you know, this is a to-do list manager or this software will help you track your Windows network or that sort of thing. So it becomes, I think that whole banner across the top, like quickly communicating what the heck the product is. And then quite often it's associated with an action item like to sign up for an evaluation or get a free account or something like that. So, you know, and that's not so much a design pattern as it is almost a marketing pattern, I guess. But that certainly seems to be one of the most popular formulas to follow.
There seems to be a bit of a schism in some ways in design where you've got that type of design that's very functional based and is very much orientated around meeting users' needs. And then on the other side of it, you're seeing some really beautiful, very ornate websites that are almost, there seems to be quite a lot of art deco type stuff around, a very flowery or that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Ornament has always been popular. And that kind of has followed the same pattern, I think, as this whole shiny style in that it's become just a whole lot more refined.
Mm.
And you see people implementing it in a whole lot better ways. Not so, you know, like, oh, I'm going to throw a flourish on here and there and that'll be it. But now it's become more like they've worked it into the entire design and almost make designs that revolve around it, which just, you know, makes a much more cleaner approach, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really stunningly beautiful stuff about it. What about you personally? I mean, what kind of design styles appeal most to you? Why, I guess?
Well, I think there's like what I call on Design Meltdown, I have a category called super clean. And you'll see sites like I'm looking at one now. It's id-confirm.com.
Right.
And they have these network identification deals. But like you just look at it and it's so clean and easy to consume. Like it's just, it's simple and yet it has enough design and pizzazz to it to where it actually feels like, you know, a really refined and high quality site. And so like that's the, I love those. And then ironically on the complete flip end, I love sites more like, and this one's a little crazier of a URL, green.yahoo.com/18seconds.
Right.
And sites like this are maybe more in line with what you were referring to. And I really love these visually intense sites where it becomes more about like the experience of what you're about to consume,
yeah,
as opposed to like just the content. And so, you know, sites like this, they got to sell you on the whole idea of what they're doing before they let you get the content, so to speak, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So, and I think I really like this approach even better, probably because I am not... I'm not quite up to making designs like this, to be completely honest.
Yeah,
it feels a little beyond me. And yeah, so you're always attracted to the things that, you know, you find most difficult. So it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, obviously sites like yours and there are other kind of similar types of sites out there. A lot of people go to these sites looking for inspiration, you know, when they're doing their own design work. I was just interested in what your opinion was on that, whether you actually thought that was healthy or whether you would encourage people to look further afield, you know, and what other places do you look for inspiration? There's a couple of questions in there, aren't there?
Yeah, there was like three or four, I think.
Sorry.
No, I think, you know, I find that my work, my coworkers come to me all the time and they're like, so what do you have on this? And I'll like point them to some articles and some, you know, this stuff to get inspired. And I think it's incredibly healthy. I think if you're going to design a site and you know the client, like, I think the key is to not come to Design Meltdown to find out what you're going to design, but to decide the elements ahead of time.
Mm.
And then come here to find like resources that match that. Like say you have a client and you know the site's going to be blue. Like, it's, you just have no choice. Like that's the client's colors or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a blue site. So you can come here and start going through blue sites and see how other people have implemented that same style.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what's quite nice about your site is because it's organized in that kind of way where you can go in and you can look at just blue sites or you can look at sites that, you know, use a particularly clean style or whatever, that it, you know, you can do it that way round in preference to just looking through hundreds of screenshots and going, I'm going to rip that one off, you know?
It's, yeah, exactly.
A much more healthy way of thinking about it. What about, do you look for inspiration beyond the web? Are you somebody that kind of looks at architecture and, you know, print magazines and stuff like that? Or are you more interested in just the web?
I would say I'm mostly... in on the web, I guess, and primarily because just to keep up on Design Meltdown, I have to catalog. I have to go through 100 sites to find 10 good ones.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it kind of forces that. But I certainly get inspired by almost anything offline. And I love going to the library, going to an old library and looking through old books because the typography is just like amazing, right?
Mm.
They're not limited by the old, like the whole computer and everything's got to line up so easily or whatever. Like it's just, so getting into older things and like going to museums and looking at old paintings, it's amazing the design skills that you can kind of see and at work in those things. So it can certainly, I think there's more than enough inspiration offline. The other thing I think people like, you know, and I get tempted to maybe make a fake paint splatter on the computer instead of getting a can of spray paint and spraying some paper and scanning it. So
yeah.
I think there's this real tendency to like think that you got to do it on the computer, whereas, you know, you can certainly unplug and do a lot of stuff to get a much more, you know, realistic feel. So,
yeah, no, I mean, I think that's great. Okay. So one last question before I let you mm-hmm. get on with looking up several more hundred sites. I have to ask you about this thing of sites like yours where people just go along to them and they basically rip off the content that they're seeing. And that's always quite a hard line for people. I don't think anybody necessarily goes along to this site going, I'm going to rip this off in its entirety, but you end up doing that. Where's the line, do you think, between being inspired by somebody's site and actually kind of overstepping that line and kind of ripping them off, so to speak?
Oh, well, I mean, that's kind of tough, isn't it? You could probably almost, most designs, like most normal down-to-earth designs, could probably be have some similarities to almost any other site, right? Like, that you've never even seen before. But I think it, I mean, it's really on the designer. If they're unethical and they choose to steal designs, then it doesn't really matter. I think it's a mindset. And I think as a young designer, people might be more tempted to base more heavily on someone else's design. And as long as you're honest about it, or you do it in cases where you're like, it's a student project or something where you're learning from this experience.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But you know, as a professional designer, you certainly just have to know, you know, you can't do that. And I think the big key is to, before you even go looking for inspiration, to think about how to solve a certain client's problems. And like, you listen to the client and find out what their needs are and what they're trying to sell and all these things. And you form like ideas on what that might mean in terms of the design. And then you can just use these as tools to kind of make you think along those lines. So,
yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the real danger comes is when you start having, you know, Photoshop open in one window and you have the web browser in another, and you're looking at one site in one window and you're designing it in Photoshop, then you've gone too far. I tell you something, I did hear once that I think works very well is instead of, if you see a website you really like, instead of doing a screen grab and keeping that, just kind of pick out individual little sections of it, little bits of it, and screen capture just, you know, the buttons or the links or the navigation.
Certainly.
You know, that works quite well as well.
Certainly.
Interesting. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Patrick. It was good to hear
from
you.
No problem.
And
hopefully,
hopefully we'll get you back again in the future.
Cool.
Okay, so we finally made it to the end of this show. It's all been very traumatic. At least I know now about the iPhone, and I can now go back to bed. I had this horrible feeling I was going to go and have to queue today, that they might actually release it today.
Bed, Paul. You've got work to do. You've been skiving for the last 4 days.
I know. Well, two of those was weekend, Marcus, and I didn't take them as holiday.
Yes, taking the weekends as holiday. Quite right,
well,
too.
You know what I mean. Monday and the Friday. Stop hassling me.
I've got
me,
another reason that I have to pick on you, Paul. I'm afraid. I think you've got the date wrong for our 100th episode.
What?
I was counting, and I think we'll be on something like 98 that week. But hey, doesn't matter.
I knew that.
Ah, right.
It's an intentional thing because I wanted. Yeah, I wanted to play on the safe side, if that makes sense, in preference to reaching 100. Because sometimes we miss episodes. Oh, I don't know. It was fine. I'm fine about it. So, yes, don't forget to sign up for the 100th episode. Let's see how many we've got coming at the moment. So that's at upcoming.yahoo.com/event/224744. We've currently got 86 people attending and 61 watching. So if you're in the watching list, move across to the attending list.
Yes.
And if you're not on the attending list, get on the attending list. We would love to see you there. It's going to be loads of free booze, and we should have a really cool evening, which I'm really looking forward to. So sign up for that. Marcus, do you want to pimp your South by Southwest panel again, or have you given up on that and accepted that you're not going to get to go for free?
I'm fairly confident. I don't know what I am, actually. I don't know. Who knows? How does anyone know how they're doing?
They don't.
Don't know.
And anyway,
well, as I said, Paul, if I don't get through, I'm not going, mate.
That's so sad.
You have to go
on
your own.
If you want to see Marcus at South by Southwest next year, please vote for him at panelpicker.southbysouthwest.com. So that's SXSW.com. I think that about wraps it up for this show. We're still working on fixing the forums for those that are interested in such things. My lead developer is incredibly slow. It's something about client work. I don't quite understand it. He was just confusing me with all his strange talk of clients. Don't understand that. But we are working on it, and the forum is still available. It's just running a little on the slow side at times. So there you go. Thank you very much for listening, and I promise
hang
I'll
on,
be...
Hang on.
Sorry, I'm not with it. Carry on.
It's a very short one. Here we go. A woman was taken to hospital where she started to complain about the number of staff, the quality of the nursing, the doctor's tie and decor. Her condition was described as critical.
That's terrible. That really is very, very bad. So on that low note, I'm giving up. Thank you very much for listening, guys, and we'll speak to you again next week. Goodbye.